The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, first published in 1532. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Part 3, Chapters 20 through 26. Chapter 20. Are fortresses and other princely devices advantageous or hurtful? Princes wanting to make their state secure have variously disarmed their subjects, encouraged factions in their subject towns, fostered hostility against themselves, set out to win over those whom they distrusted at the start of their reign, built fortresses and destroyed fortresses. A final judgment on these things can only be made in the light of the particular facts regarding each state, but I will discuss this matter as comprehensively as the topic permits. No new prince has ever disarmed his subjects. Rather, when any new prince has found the people unarmed, he has armed them. Why? Because by arming them, you make those arms yours. The men whom you distrusted become loyal, those who were already loyal remain so, and your subjects become your supporters. Not all the subjects can be armed, and those who are armed are receiving a privilege, but this won't get you into trouble with the others. They will understand that the armed men are bound to you, are likely to be put in harm's way on your behalf, and so deserve a greater reward, and they won't hold it against you that you gave that privilege to some and not to others. But when you disarm your subjects, you at once offend them by giving evidence that you are either cowardly or naturally distrustful, and either of those opinions will make you hated. And since you can't survive without some army, and since you have disarmed your subjects, you have to turn to mercenaries. And I've already shown what they are like. And even if you had good mercenaries, they wouldn't be enough to defend you against powerful enemies and subjects whom you don't trust. So, I repeat, new princes in new principalities have always distributed arms among their subjects. Generations ago, the experts used to say that Pistoia can only be held by factions and Pisa only by fortresses. And this idea, or a generalized version of it, led them to foment quarrels in some of their tributary towns, so as to make them easier to dominate. Back then, when there was a kind of balance of power in Italy, this may have been a sound enough policy, but I don't think it is acceptable today, because I don't think that factions now can ever be of use. On the contrary, when a city divided by factions is attacked from the outside, it will quickly be lost, because the weaker faction will always help the external attacker, and the other won't be able to resist. I think the Venetians were following this policy when they stirred up trouble between the Guelph and Ghibelline factions in their subject cities. Without letting the trouble come to bloodshed, the Venetians encouraged these disputes so that the citizens wouldn't unite against them. We saw that this didn't work out in the way they expected, because after the Venetians' defeat at Vela in 1509, one of the two factions took courage and seized the state. A prince's following this policy shows that he is weak, because these factional quarrels won't be permitted in any vigorous principality. In times of peace, it is a policy for managing subjects, but in times of war, it is sheer folly. There's no doubt that a prince becomes great when he overcomes difficulties and obstacles. For this reason, when Fortuna wants greatness to come to a new prince, who needs a personal reputation more than a hereditary prince does, it causes enemies to arise and turns them against him. This gives him the opportunity to overcome them, climbing higher on this ladder that his enemies have brought to him. That's why many people think that a wise prince should, when the opportunity presents itself, engineer some hostility against himself, so that he can crush it, and thus elevate his level of fame. Princes, especially new ones, have often received more loyalty and support from men they had distrusted at the outset than from those whom they had trusted. Pandolfo Petrucci, Prince of Siena, governed his state with more help from those he had initially distrusted than from others. But one can't generalize on this topic, because individual cases vary so much. I'll just say this. Men who have been hostile at the start of a principality, and who don't have the rank or status needed to support themselves without help, can easily be won over by the prince. They'll be strongly bound to serve him loyally, because they'll know how important it is to them to act in ways that will cancel the bad impression he had formed of them. So the prince always gets better value from them than from men who serve him neglectfully, because they are so sure of their position with him. I should warn any prince who has taken over a new state with the help of its inhabitants that he should think hard about their motives in helping him. If they were motivated not by any natural affection for him, but only by discontent with their government, then he'll find it very hard to remain friends with them, because it will be impossible to make them contented with him. With this in mind, in the light of the reasons for it, look at all the ancient and modern examples. You'll find that it is easier for a prince to make friends of men who were contented under the former government, and are therefore his enemies, than of those who were discontented with that government, and wanted and enabled him to seize power. Typical of the first group are experienced civil servants. Typical of the second are now unemployed revolutionaries. Princes wanting to increase the security of their states have often built fortresses. A fortress can serve as a bridle and bit, reining in potential enemies, and as a place of refuge from a first attack. I praise this as a time-hallowed practice, yet in our times we have seen these events. Niccolò Vitelli demolished two fortresses in Città di Castello as an aid to holding on to the town. The Duke of Urbino drove Cesare Borgia out of his dominion, and then flattened all the fortresses in that province, which he thought he could hold more easily with the fortresses gone. The Bentivogli regained power in Bologna, and followed the same policy. Whether a fortress is useful, then, depends on the circumstances. If they help you in one way, they harm you in another. Here is a way of looking at this. A prince who is more afraid of his own people than of foreigners ought to build fortresses, but one who fears foreigners more than he does his people ought to do without them. The castle that Francesco Sforza had built in Milan has given the Sforza family more trouble than any of that state's other disorders, and it will go on doing so. The best possible fortress for a prince is not being hated by his people. If you have fortresses, and your people hate you, the fortresses won't do you any good. An openly rebellious populace will have no shortage of foreigners wanting to come to their aid against you. No prince in our times has found fortresses to be useful to him, with the limited exception of the Countess of Forlì. When her husband died in 1488, her fortress enabled her to withstand the popular attack and wait for help from Milan, thus recovering her state. The circumstances at that time were such that no foreigners could help the rebellious people. But fortresses didn't do much for her in 1499, when Cesare Borgia attacked her, and when her hostile people were allied with foreigners. At both those times, she'd have been better off having subjects who didn't hate her than she was with fortresses. All these things considered, then, I'll praise any prince who builds fortresses, as well as any who doesn't. And I'll blame any prince who doesn't mind being hated by his people, because he is relying on his fortresses. Chapter 21. What a Prince Should Do to Acquire Prestige. Nothing builds a prince's prestige more than his undertaking great enterprises and his setting a fine example by his personal conduct. We have in our time Ferdinand of Aragon, the present King of Spain. He can almost be called a new prince, because his fame and glory have raised him from being an insignificant king to being the foremost king in the Christian world. At the start of his reign, he attacked Granada, the Moorish kingdom in southern Spain, and this campaign laid the foundations of his power. he proceeded quietly at first, with no worries about being interfered with. He kept the barons of Castile busy thinking about the war and not planning any changes inside Spain, and they didn't notice that by these means he was increasing his prestige and his power over them. Ferdinand financed his army with money from the church and from taxes, and through that long war he built a military establishment that has since brought him honour. Further, under cover of religion, he embarked on greater schemes, with pious cruelty, hunting out the Jews in his kingdom and expelling them. A pitiful state of affairs, brought about by an extraordinary act. Under this same religious cloak, he attacked Africa, invaded Italy, and now has attacked France. Thus, Ferdinand has always planned and acted on a grandiose scale, keeping his subjects' minds in a state of amazement and anxiety about what was going to happen next. And his actions have followed one another so quickly that there has never been a quiet time in which men could work steadily against him. A prince can be greatly helped by striking acts of government in internal affairs. King Ferdinand did well on this score also, and there is a striking example of it in the reported acts of Bernabò Visconti, Prince of Milan. Whenever any civilian did something extraordinary, whether good or bad, Bernabò would devise a reward or punishment that everyone talked about. A prince ought above all to try to get, through all his actions, the reputation of being a great and remarkable man. A prince also gains prestige from being either a true friend or an outright enemy, saying openly which side he favours in any conflict. This will always serve better than staying neutral. Here is why. Suppose that two of your powerful neighbours are at war, and you are wondering what to do. Well, you'll do best by not staying neutral, but rather picking a side and fighting hard for it. If the two combatants are both very powerful, then if you stay neutral, you'll inevitably fall prey to the winner, and you'll have no excuses, no defence, and nowhere to hide. And how the loser in the conflict will enjoy this. Neither side will befriend you. The winner won't want friends whom he can't depend on in times of trial. And the loser won't give you shelter because you didn't take sword in hand and share his danger with him. Thus, it will always happen that the one who isn't your friend will ask you to keep out of it, while your friend will ask you to fight on his side. Indecisive princes usually try to avoid immediate danger by taking the neutral route, and they are usually ruined by this choice. But when a prince briskly declares himself in favour of one side, if the side you choose is the winner, then you have a good friend who is indebted to you. It's true that the winner may be powerful enough to have you at his mercy, but he won't use that against you. If he did, that would be a monument of ingratitude, and men are never as low as that. Victories are never so complete that the victor has no need to be careful about anything, no need, especially, to be careful about justice. But if the side you choose loses, he may give you shelter and help you for as long as he can, so that you become companions in a fortuna that may rise again. If, on the other hand, the power level of the combatants is such that you have nothing to fear from either, there's an even stronger prudential reason for you to choose a side. Why? Because the side you choose is certain to win, so that you help in the destruction of one prince with the help of another prince, and that other prince, having with your assistance won a war that he couldn't have won without you, is now at your mercy. And here I should point out that a prince should be careful never to make an alliance with a more powerful prince for the purposes of attacking others, unless circumstances force him into this. If he wins, you will be at his mercy, and princes should do everything they can to avoid being at anyone's mercy. Witness two recent examples. The Venetians forming an alliance that led to their ruin, and the Florentines forming an alliance when they absolutely had to. No government should ever think that it can choose perfectly safe courses of action. Every government should expect to have to run risks, because in the ordinary course of events, one never tries to avoid one trouble without running into another. prudence consists in knowing how to weigh up troubles and choose the lesser ones. Chapter 22. The Ministers of Princes. A prince ought also to show himself a patron of virtue, and to honour those who are talented in any art or craft. And he should encourage his citizens to carry steadily on with their ordinary occupations, in commerce, agriculture, and so on, so that no one is deterred from increasing his holdings by the fear that they'll be confiscated, or deterred from starting up business as a trader by fear of duties and taxes. Rather, the prince should create incentives for doing these things, and for doing anything else that improves his city or state. Also, he should entertain the people with banquets and shows at appropriate times of the year, and as every city is divided into guilds or clans, he should treat such bodies with respect, go to some of their meetings, and present himself as a model of courtesy and generosity, though always maintaining the majesty of his rank, which he must never allow to be diminished. A prince's choice of ministers is important to him, and it's up to him, to his intelligent foresight, whether he has good ones. The first opinion that one forms of a prince's intelligence comes from observing the men he has around him. When they are competent and loyal, he should be regarded as shrewd, because he has known how to spot competence in people, and to keep them loyal. But when they are otherwise, mediocre or disloyal, one can't have a good opinion of him, because his choice of ministers was his first big mistake. There are three kinds of intellect. A superb intellect, which understands things unaided. A good intellect, which understands things when others explain them. A useless intellect, which doesn't understand anything, even with help. If Pandolfo's intellect wasn't of the first type, therefore, it was of the second. Someone with enough judgment to evaluate what others say and do, even if he isn't capable of originality, can tell when a minister is performing well and when he isn't, and can praise in one case and scold in the other, so the minister can't hope to deceive him and is kept honest. A prince has one infallible test of the quality of a minister. When you see the minister thinking more for himself than for you, keeping an eye on his own advantage in everything he does, he'll never be a good minister, and you'll never be able to trust him. Someone with another person's government in his hands ought never to think of himself, but always of his prince, spending no time on anything in which the prince is not concerned. On the other hand, to keep his minister honest, the prince should think about his welfare, honour him, enrich him, do him kindnesses, confer honours and executive responsibilities on him, feeding his desire for power and influence, and at the same time the prince should let the minister see that he can't survive without the prince. He should have so much wealth and honour that he won't want more of either, and have so many offices that he'll be afraid of any change of regime. Chapter 23. How to Avoid Flatterers. I don't want to leave undiscussed an important matter, an error that it's hard for a prince not to fall into unless he's very shrewd or very good at selecting men to serve him. I'm talking about flatterers. Princely courts are full of them, and it's hard for a prince to protect himself from the plague they bring, because princes, like men in general, are so pleased with their own doings and so deceived about them. A prince who tries to defend himself against flattery runs a risk of being contemned. The only way to guard yourself from flatterers is to make it known that you aren't offended by being told the truth, but you won't get much respect when you are seen as someone to whom anyone can safely tell the truth. So a wise prince will steer a different course between listening to flatterers and listening to everyone, namely, assembling a cabinet of wise men and giving the freedom to tell him the truth, only to them, and only in answer to questions he has put to them. But he should question them about everything, listen to their opinions, and then form his own conclusions. When dealing with these advisers, as a group or separately, the prince should implicitly convey to each of them the message, "The more openly you speak to me, the better I will like it." he shouldn't listen to anyone else, but should resolutely stand by and act on the decisions he has made. If he doesn't have this policy, either he'll be ruined by flatterers, or will change course so often, because of the different opinions he listens to, that people will lose their respect for him. I want to illustrate this with a contemporary example. Father Luca Rinaldi, in service to Maximilian, the present emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, has said that his employer never consulted anyone, yet never got his own way in anything. And this arose from proceeding in the opposite way to the one I have been advocating. The emperor is a secretive man. He doesn't tell anyone what he is planning, and doesn't ask anyone about it either. But when he starts to carry something into effect, it becomes revealed and known. His courtiers raise objections, and he changes course. The result is that he does something on one day, and undoes it the next. No one ever understands what he wants or plans to do, and no one can rely on his decisions. A prince, therefore, should always take advice, but only when he wants it, not when others want to give it. He should discourage everyone from offering advice uninvited, but he should constantly ask questions and listen patiently to the answers. And any time he learns that the answerer is holding back about something, he should let his anger be felt. It is sometimes thought that any prince who conveys an impression of intelligence owes this not to his own ability, but to the good advisers that he has around him. But this is certainly wrong. Here is an infallible rule. A prince who isn't wise himself can't take good advice, unless he happens to have put his affairs entirely in the hands of one very prudent man. In this case, things may go well, but not for long, because such an adviser would soon take his state away from him. But if an inexperienced prince gets advice from more than one man, the bits of advice he gets won't form a unity, and he won't know how to pull them together into a unity. Each of the advisers will be thinking of his own interests, and the prince won't know how to control them, or even to see what they're up to. And it's not a matter of finding better advisers. Men will always be untrustworthy unless they are forced to be honest. Conclusion. Good advice, wherever it comes from, is a product of the prince's wisdom, not vice versa. Chapter 24. Why the Princes of Italy Have Lost Their States. A new prince, if he carefully follows the procedures I have been recommending in Part 2 of this work, will come across as having a principality that is hereditary and long established, and this will quickly make his government secure and stable. More so, indeed, than if he really had been a prince for a long time, because a new prince's actions are watched more closely than those of a hereditary prince, and when they are seen to have a high level of virtue, they win more men over and get them more committed than an old princely bloodline can do. Why would that be so? Well, men care more about the present than about the past, and when they like the way things are at present, they just enjoy it, and don't look any further. Indeed, they'll do everything they can to defend a prince under whom the present is satisfactory, as long as he doesn't let them down in other ways. Thus, it will be a double glory for him to have established a new principality, and adorned and strengthened it with good laws, good arms, good allies, and a good example, just as it will be a double disgrace for someone who comes into a hereditary principality and loses power because of his stupidity. Look at the gentlemen who have lost their states in Italy in our times. The King of Naples, the Duke of Milan, and others. They had two defects in common. Their military arrangements were poor. I discussed this at length early in Part 2, and each of them had his people hostile to him, or had his people friendly to him, but didn't know how to protect himself against the nobles. Any state that is strong enough to keep an army in the field can't be lost if it doesn't have either of those two defects. So our princes who have lost their principalities after many years of possession shouldn't blame their loss on Fortuna. The real culprit is their own indolence, going through quiet times with no thought of the possibility of change. It's a common human fault, failing to prepare for tempests unless one is actually in one. And when eventually bad times did come, these slack princes thought of flight rather than self-defence, hoping that the people upset by the conqueror's insolence would recall them. This course of action may be all right when there's no alternative, but it is not all right to neglect alternatives and choose this one. It amounts to voluntarily falling because you think that in due course someone will pick you up. If you do get rescued, and you probably won't, that won't make you secure. The only rescue that is really helpful to you is the one performed by you, the one that depends on yourself and your virtue. Chapter 25. The Role of Fortuna in Human Affairs, and How to Withstand It. I'm well aware that many men, past and present, have thought that the affairs of the world are governed by fortuna, in such a way that human prudence can't get a grip on them, and we have no way of protecting ourselves. These people hold that we needn't sweat much over things, and that we should leave everything to chance. This opinion has been more widespread in our day because of the huge changes in affairs that we have seen and that are still going on, changes that no one could have predicted. Sometimes, when I think about this, I am a little inclined that way myself. However, so as not to put our free will entirely out of business, I contend that fortuna decides half of our actions, leaving the other half, or perhaps a bit less, to our decisions. I compare fortuna to one of those raging rivers which, when in flood, overflow the plains, sweep away trees and buildings, pick up soil in one place and dump it elsewhere. Everyone tries to escape such a flood. No one can do anything to hold it back. Everyone capitulates to its violence. But despite all that, when the weather turns fair and the river calms down, men can prepare for the next time by building dikes and dams, so that when the river is next in flood, it will stay within its banks, or at least not be so uncontrolled and damaging. That's how it is with fortuna, which shows its power in places where virtue hasn't made preparations to resist it. It sends its forces in directions where it knows that barriers and defences haven't been raised to constrain it. Think about Italy. It is the scene of such changes. It set them in motion, and it is, metaphorically speaking, open countryside, with no dams, no dikes. If proper virtue had been put into building defences, as was done in Germany, Spain, and France, this flood of foreign invasions wouldn't have had such severe effects, and might not have happened at all. That's all I need to say in general terms about resistance to fortuna. But there is one more detailed matter that I want to discuss. We see that a prince can be happy today and ruined tomorrow, without any change in himself. I think that this is to be explained mostly through the matter I have been discussing. A prince who relies entirely on fortuna is lost when it changes, but it may also be due to something else that I shall now present. A prince whose actions fit the spirit of the times will be successful, whereas one whose actions are out of tune with the times will fail. In projects aiming at what everyone aims at, namely glory and riches, it's clear that different men proceed differently. One proceeds with caution, another impetuously, one by force, another by skill, one prepared to wait things out, another plunging in with no delay. And each type of procedure can lead to success. It's also clear that these sometimes happen. Of two men who both proceed cautiously, one succeeds and the other fails. One man proceeds cautiously, another impetuously, and they both succeed. This is all a matter of whether a man's way of proceeding conforms to the spirit of the times. Rises and falls in people's individual welfare are also affected by this. Consider someone who manages his affairs with caution and patience. If the times and circumstances come together in a way that fits his methods, his fortune is made. But if times and circumstances change, he is ruined. Unless he changes his whole approach, but no one will do that. There are two reasons a man might have for refusing to change course. He can't go against his natural inclinations, or he can't be talked out of behaving in a way that has worked well for him for so long. So the cautious man, when the time comes to plunge ahead, doesn't know how to do it, and thus he is ruined. If he had changed his conduct to fit the times, his fortuna would have stayed level. Pope Julius II did everything impetuously, and the times and circumstances conformed so well to that approach that he always succeeded. Consider his first campaign against Bologna, when Giovanni Bentivogli was still alive. The Venetians didn't want him to do this, nor did the King of Spain, and he was discussing the enterprise with the French king. But with his accustomed boldness and energy, Julius embarked on this campaign, leading it in person. Spain and the Venetians stood by passively, the Venetians from fear, and Spain from a desire to recover the kingdom of Naples. And France? Julius drew the French king into the campaign because the king wanted him as an ally in checking the power of the Venetians. And now that Julius had made his move, a refusal to help him would have been too much of a snub. Thus, Julius, with his impetuous action, achieved something that no other pope could have pulled off, with all the prudence in the world. For if he had stayed in Rome until everything had been agreed and settled, as any other pope would have done, he would never have succeeded. The King of France would have made 1,000 excuses for not helping, and the others would have raised 1,000 fears of how things might go wrong if he went ahead. Fortuna changes, and men don't change in their ways of going about things. So long as the two agree, men are successful. When they quarrel, men are unsuccessful. I think it is better to be adventurous than to be cautious, because Fortuna is a woman, and if you want to stay on top of her, you have to slap and thrust, and it's clear that she is more apt to submit to those who approach her in that way than to those who go about the business calmly. As a woman, she is always more partial to young men, because they are less cautious, more aggressive, bolder when they master her. Chapter 26. A Plea to Liberate Italy from the Barbarians. Thinking back over everything I have written up to here, I ask myself whether the time is now ripe for the entry of a new prince, and whether Italy now contains materials that a wise and high virtue prince could shape into a new order of things that would bring honour to him and good to the people of this country. My answer is yes. So many things are coming together to favour a new prince. It seems to me that I can't think of any time more fit than the present. I have said that the virtue of Moses couldn't have been shown if the people of Israel hadn't been in captivity, that Cyrus's greatness of soul couldn't have been revealed if the Persians hadn't been oppressed by the Medes, and that the fine abilities of Theseus wouldn't have been put to work if the Athenians hadn't been scattered. If that is all correct, then the great virtue of a great Italian spirit couldn't be shown until Italy reached rock bottom, as it has now done, more enslaved than the Hebrews, more oppressed than the Persians, more scattered than the Athenians, with no leader, no government, beaten, robbed, lacerated, overrun, enduring every kind of desolation. Not long ago, there was someone, Cesare Borgia, who showed a spark of greatness that might have made one think God had ordained him to rescue Italy. But at the height of his career, it was obvious that Fortuna had turned against him, so that Italy, half dead, is still waiting for someone to heal its wounds and put an end to the ravaging of Lombardy and to the extortionate taxing of the kingdom of Naples and Tuscany, cleansing the sores that have festered for so long. It's clear that Italy is begging God to send someone who will deliver it from this cruel ill-treatment at the hands of foreigners. It's also clear that Italy is ready and willing to march behind a flag, if only someone will raise one. I address myself now to Lorenzo Di Piero de' Medici, to whom this work is dedicated. The only hope for Italy that anyone can see right now lies in your distinguished family, the Medici, with its fortuna and virtue, favoured by God and by the Church, of which it is now the head. It could be the leader in the rescuing of Italy. This won't be hard to do, as you'll realise if you bring back to mind the actions and lives of the men I have named, Moses, Cyrus, and Theseus. They were indeed great and wonderful men, but still they were only men, and none of them had any more opportunity than is offered by Italy today. Their undertakings weren't more just than this or easier than this, and God wasn't more their friend than he is yours. Our cause is utterly just, because, as the Latin historian Livy said, wars are just when they are necessary, and arms are sacred when they are your only hope. The circumstances are utterly favourable. And when that's the case, the difficulties can't be great if you'll only follow the three men I have presented as models. Furthermore, God has given us extraordinary, indeed unprecedented, signs. Metaphorically speaking, the sea has divided, a cloud has led the way, water has gushed from a rock, manna has rained down, events have come together to contribute to your greatness. It's for you to do the rest. God doesn't like doing everything, depriving us of our free will and of our share in the glory. It's not surprising that none of the Italians I have talked about have been able to do everything that I think your distinguished family can do. Nor is it surprising that in all Italy's wars and revolutions it has seemed that military virtue was exhausted. It was because the old way of doing things, in government or in war, was bad, and no one has been able to devise a new one. For a man who has newly risen to the top, nothing brings him more honour than devising new laws and new practices. When such things are solid and show vision, they will bring him respect and admiration. And in Italy there's no shortage of matter waiting to be given form. Here in Italy there is great virtue in the limbs, but it's missing from the head. That is, individual soldiers are fine, but the military leadership is not. Look attentively at the individual duels and hand-to-hand combats that have been fought, how superior the Italians are in strength, dexterity, and skill. But when it comes to armies, there's no comparison, and that's because they are badly led. The really able officers aren't obeyed, and everyone thinks that he knows best. And there has never been anyone whose virtue and fortuna have made him stand out so that the others would stand aside and let him lead. That's why for so long, in so much fighting in the past 20 years, no holy Italian army has done well. As witness what happened at the River Taro, then Alessandri, Capua, Genoa, Vela, Bologna, Mestre. So if your illustrious family wants to follow those remarkable men who came to the rescue of their countries, the main thing you have to do, the foundation of everything else, is to provide yourself with your own army, because no mercenaries or foreign auxiliaries can possibly be more loyal, more reliable, better soldiers than your own citizen soldiers will be. And good as each individual citizen soldier will be, taken together as a unit, they will be even better when they find that they are commanded, paid, and honoured by their prince. That's the sort of army you must have, if foreigners are to be beaten back by Italian virtue. The opportunity for Italy at last to have its liberator ought not to be missed. I have no doubt at all that he would be received with great affection by all the provinces that have been washed out by the foreign flood, as well as having a thirst for revenge, stubborn faith, devotion, and tears of gratitude. What doors would be closed to such a man? Who would refuse to obey him? What envy would hinder him? What Italian would deny him homage? This occupation by barbarians stinks in all our nostrils. So may your distinguished family undertake this mission with the courage and hope that go with all just enterprises, so that under your standard our country may be ennobled, and under your auspices what Petrarch wrote may turn out to be true. Valour will take up arms against wild attacks, and the battle will be short, for ancient valour is still strong in Italian hearts. End of chapters 20 to 26. End of the work.